go in love, 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 love. I hear it far, far away. And I am waiting for you. Yes, I am waiting for you. Whatever waiting means in this new place, I am waiting for you. Yes, I am waiting for you. I am waiting for you.
Michael Stipe and Aaron Dessner performing their song No Time for Love at Democracy Now's 30th anniversary celebration. To watch the full event with Patti Stipe, with Patti Smith, as well as Bruce Springsteen, go to democracynow.org. These aren't happy times, but Nermeen, happy, happy birthday!
Yay!
KB, Portland.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the Laurelhurst Theater, part of Portland's cultural and architectural history since 1923, presenting first-run movies with air conditioning, pizza, and beer. More information, including showtimes and tickets, is available at laurelhursttheater.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, thousands of people in Oregon and Washington are getting ready to rally with a National Day of Action demanding that our country have no kings, a new ban against transgender women in the Olympics, and the pain of unpaid TSA workers hits home at PDX. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 26, 2026. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Thousands will gather across Oregon on this Saturday, March 28th, for the third No Kings National Day of Action. As Isabel Charlet reports, organizers are calling for what they term hyper-local organizing against the Trump administration under the slogan, Everybody, Everywhere, All at Once.
Dozens of No Kings events are set to take place across Oregon this Saturday. The events are expected to draw tens of thousands of people rallying against what organizers describe as rising fascism in the country. Keir Carson is with Indivisible Oregon, the grassroots group co-organizing the events. He says participants are invited to engage on a hyper-local level, inspired in part by local resistance to ICE activity in Minneapolis.
The idea was occupy your corner. But occupy your corner, everybody, everywhere, all at once, so that you cannot drive through the Portland metropolitan area without seeing someone on the corner with a sign of resistance.
Portland isn't the only spot. From Ashland to Burns to Pendleton, multiple protests are planned. New data from the University of Washington Center for Human Rights show ICE arrests increased dramatically at the end of last year in the region, with over 2,200 in the final 3 months of 2025. Organizers are calling for an end to ICE activity in Oregon and for agents who break the law to be prosecuted. The Trump administration says all actions carried out by ICE have been legal and has called for immunity for all agents. Carson says many people are feeling overwhelmed by the political climate right now, but emphasizes that getting involved can help make them feel better. He adds every action, whether it's writing postcards or talking with neighbors, is important.
Whatever your generation is or whatever your interest is, there's a group out there that you can get involved with.
About 7 million people participated in the last No Kings protests in October, held across 2,700 locations nationwide. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
As folks who feel the United States has gone off track take to the streets again Saturday for the third round of No Kings protests, Kathleen Carson is with Seattle Indivisible. It's a grassroots group co-organizing the events. She says Saturday will focus on inviting people to engage in community organizing on a very local level, block by block, inspired by local resistance to ICE activity in Minneapolis.
It really starts at the neighborhood level and making sure that you know the people next to you, because that's how we protect our vulnerable neighbors and also just build that resilience in our community.
New information from the University of Washington Center for Human Rights shows statewide ICE arrests increased dramatically at the end of last year. The International Olympic Committee has just handed down a decision Donald Trump should like very much, but others view it as a setback for human rights. KBOO's Josh Salem tells us more.
The International Olympic Committee just banned transgender women athletes from the Games. The ban aligns with Donald Trump's executive order on women's sports ahead of the 2028 Los Angeles Summer Olympics. The committee said, quote, eligibility for any female category event at the Olympic Games or any other IOC event, including individual and team sports, is now limited to biological females determined on the basis of a one-time SRY gene screening, end quote. It suggested the policy, quote, protects fairness, safety, and integrity in the female category. It is unclear if any transgender women are competing at an Olympic level. No woman who transitioned from being born male competed at the 2024 Paris Summer Games. Ironically, the Olympic Charter states that access to play sport is a human right. It is clear the policy will not be applied retroactively. The committee published a 10-page policy document, which also restricts female athletes with medical conditions known as differences in sex development. The committee preferred to have a definitive policy instead of continuing to advise sports governing bodies who previously have drafted their own rules. Female eligibility was a strong theme in a 7-candidate IOC presidential election last year. The eventual victor, Kirsty Coventry, might have been reacting to her main rival's pledge to put forward a stronger policy on the issue. Before the 2024 Paris Olympics, three top-tier sports, track and field, swimming, and cycling, already had passed rules excluding transgender women who had been through male puberty. The IOC claims research shows that being born male gives physical advantages that are retained, with testosterone peaks while in the womb, during infancy, and beginning at adolescence. It claims the hormone gives males, quote, individual sex-based performance advantages in sports and events that rely on strength, power, and or endurance. The gene test screens for the SRY gene, a segment of DNA said to be typically found on the Y chromosome that initiates male sex development in utero. The committee claims it represents highly accurate evidence that an athlete has experienced male sexual development. Trump signed his executive order keeping men out of women's sports in February last year. He pledged to deny visas to some athletes attempting to compete at the LA Olympics, and to rescind all funds from organizations that allow transgender athletes to take part in women's sports. The mandatory gender screening is likely to be criticized by human rights experts and activist groups. The test itself has predominantly been used in disorders of sex development, not for gender determination. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Candace Williams is the executive director of the group For All Families Oregon. It's a group of parents, employers, caregivers, and activists pushing for the community to do more to support working families with policies that are good for the families, businesses, and for Oregon as a whole.
I'm a parent of two amazing kiddos, a 16-year-old who is currently at Many Nations Academy, and the parent of a college sophomore at Tuskegee University, the Tuskegee, who has huge aspirations to be involved in our state's work when he comes back from Alabama, because he knows from his experiences with his mom how much care matters in our community. I'm also a fourth generation of the historical Black albina community here in Portland, Oregon. And this is a community that has consistently been together and supporting each other and making sure that we are uplifting the unnamed, unheard, unpaid, and often undervalued caregiving community that has consistently kept our economy, our community, all of our backbone growing. At FAFO, For All Families Oregon, our whole goal is to uplift and to center the voices of mothers and caregivers across this state in all things related to care, reproductive justice, racial justice, and economic justice. We know that we all share struggles and we share hardships, but we also share joy, and we share in the fruits of the labors that we engage in together, and we work together to create the change that our community needs at the systemic level. But the sad reality is that our families currently are under attack from the federal government and at times from our local government. And those attacks have often shown folks who can turn their backs on our children. Our children don't have a voice. They don't have a vote. We are witnessing a coordinated assault on our most fundamental promise to our kids, that every kid in every community deserves a safe and healthy start to life. And that's what we want for Oregon's kids.
What do population trends and the availability of preschool and childcare have in common? Turns out a lot when it comes to Oregon's most populous county.
We had to kind of mobilize as a community.
Multnomah County is starting to grow in population again after several years of decline since COVID.
The argument has always been tax is going to drive people out.
That's Portland City Councilor Mitch Green. He's an economist and says community leaders who blame a higher tax for people leaving Multnomah County are wrong.
People left because of the preschool for all tax, which is bubkis.
He says he and another economist crunched the numbers and published papers finding
there's no correlation at all between this divergence of incomes for those staying in the county and those leaving. If you look at where folks go when they leave Multnomah County, they're going to places like California. That's not exactly a low tax haven.
District 4 Councilor Green puts on his professor hat.
The critique from the business community, it's a bad faith critique. That's never been born in any kind of data. And it sounds very much like a Reagan and Thatcher style argument that if you've got a certain tax on income earners in the upper parts of the income distribution, then you're going to disincentivize their participation in our community. But the core of it really is about rich folks not wanting to pay this tax. Last spring, we had to mobilize as a community to defend this program because we came under a series of increasing attacks, first from the tax advisory group convened by Governor Kotek, but it was very much a Portland Metro Chamber sort of enterprise, as well as a lot of other kind of business. They created the presumption of cause and effect that then led us to say, well, we've seen this flight from Multnomah County over the last few years, and we also know that we had these other taxes, so therefore it must follow that people left because of the preschool for all tax. It relied upon this data that comes from the IRS that basically said that if you look up all the people leaving the county versus all the people coming into the county and you sum up their tax filings and then you average it across the number of people coming and going, then it looks like people leaving have higher incomes than people coming in. The issue with that is you can't average that data in that kind of way and draw any meaningful conclusions. And if you look at the county's data, we did not see that story bore out. In recent years, the number of filers who are required to pay the tax grows because the income distribution continues to get heavier, where we have more and more well-to-do households and more households that are having a hard time. I have an economist on my staff who's also trained to look at these things critically. We published a couple of papers that walked through those claims. There's no correlation at all between this divergence of incomes for those staying and those leaving. There's just one year in particular that skews all that, and it's in 2021. And we had a really high stock market rally. So folks who earn their income primarily through capital gains, the very wealthy, they saw a big jump in their earnings that year. That juiced the revenue that we got from the preschool for all tax. But that was a one-off case. From 2021 forward, it looks like we had declining revenue. They glommed onto that and said, we've got these people leaving. It must be because we're driving these higher income earners out of the county. But if you look at where folks go when they leave Multnomah County, they're going to places like California. And so folks who are leaving Multnomah County who might be paying this tax going to California, that's also a very high tax state. When the business community is talking about the tax migration effect, they like to talk about that Multnomah County or Oregon or the local jurisdiction has the second or the highest marginal tax rate and pretend that's impacting all of us. But there's only some of us who pay the top marginal tax rates because it's for a minority of well-to-do people. If you look at the average effective tax rate, Oregon is right in the middle of comparable states. If you look at the median age of folks who come to Multnomah County, they're much younger. Their incomes are lower, and they want to get a start in life in a place that's more welcoming for them. They want to flee oppressive family structures or political structures in other parts of the world. They come to Multnomah County because we're an open and welcoming place. And then they realize, well, shoot, I can't afford to raise my budding household given the cost of childcare, given the cost of housing, and my wages aren't keeping up. If we really care about affordability for our working households, you ought to protect the preschool for all program at all costs, because that is a $20,000 to $25,000 benefit that households get just by not having to pad a pocket for that. One of the single largest predictors of economic inequality is whether or not someone has access, universal access to early childcare and education. If we invest in those families and make this a universal program, then we've leveled the playing field from workers from any race, class or gender intersection, children who then become workers later on. When companies come here and locate their businesses, they do so because they can benefit from a labor market that has a broad pool of talent. That's why you have the big apparel companies here. We've got this design and knowledge economy in Portland that only gets better when we expand things like early childhood education.
Meantime, East Portland area State Senator Con Pham points to recent dangerous accidents in which potholes are a suspected cause as she took a ride on the bus.
We don't have a lot of spaces in modern life where people from different backgrounds actually have to be in shared space together. Now we're so segregated by income and race, and admittedly, we're also still segregated by race and income on the bus, but I think it still offers the potential for conversations and connections. We have more transportation options than other districts, but it's still really challenging. My constituents talk to me about struggling to be able to get to work and to school. The roads are full of potholes. I do think legislators need to take self-critical view and some accountability to the sorry state of transportation funding. The result of decades of disinvestment and lack of attention, there's a real reckoning that we have to do in the legislature.
She's taking a new role on the Joint Transportation Oversight Committee.
We really think it's about holding ODOT accountable for some of the climate action goals that they have, the public transit responsibilities that they hold, as well as the safety, the epidemic of traffic fatalities. That's a goal and a metric that we need to be measuring ODOT's success on, and we are failing the people of Oregon right now.
And Oregon Congresswoman Maxine Dexter is also worried about transportation, but she's looking at airports and TSA workers, including PDX.
People just want their time in airports to be uneventful. They want to get through security, get to their gate, and get to their home and their families, onto their travels, without chaos, delays, or confusion. The White House is making that impossible. Rather than working with Democrats to fund TSA, Trump is sending ICE agents into our country's airports. ICE agents are not trained in aviation security or customer service. They are not able to help TSA agents who have been working without pay for 47% of this fiscal year. ICE agents create fear, confusion, and certainly more chaos in our airports. There's a better way. Republicans should focus on sending paychecks, not ICE, to our airports and let Americans get where they are going safely and uneventfully. Here at the Portland Airport, you can see people are still traveling, but you know, what's not normal is TSA is still not getting paid. These folks are living paycheck to paycheck already. They can't afford to continue to go unpaid. This is a political choice. This is not a resource problem. We have a discharge petition on the table that we are forcing the issue as Democrats because the Republicans refuse to negotiate on CBP and ICE. They're holding TSA, Coast Guard, FEMA, all hostage because the Republicans refuse to negotiate on taking off the masks and forcing enforcement of the Constitution for ICE and CBP. Please, whatever you can do in buckets or the boxes in the airport, thank them. Just make sure that you are kind, patient, and making sure that you can think about what it would be like to go 40% of a year without pay.
Washington U.S. Senator Patty Murray is also worried about those TSA workers and the talks to get them paid.
TSA agents are going without pay. Travelers are showing up at our airports to find 3, 4, or even 5 hour security lines, and Trump and Republicans are refusing to just fund TSA. Democrats have tried again and again to pay TSA while negotiations continue on reforms on ICE and Border Patrol. But Republicans have now blocked us 8 times. and it's counting. We have tried to send TSA agents the paychecks they deserve. Trump has responded by sending ICE instead. TSA agents do not need ICE officers hovering over their shoulders and intimidating travelers. They need to get paid. There is no excuse for the chaos Republicans have caused at our airports. Now, some of my Democratic colleagues and I have had productive meetings with the White House as we press for meaningful reforms to ICE. But they would be a lot more productive if the president didn't keep making new and unreasonable demands over social media. It is awfully hard to find common ground with Republicans when it's not clear that they have common ground amongst themselves. Until recently, the Republican position was, we won't let you give a dollar to TSA unless you cut a blank check to Stephen Miller. That is absurd. But now we have made some headway toward reforms. Trump told Republicans maybe he doesn't want these negotiations at all. He won't accept any deal to fund TSA or the rest of the department until Congress passes his voter suppression bill. He is actually holding TSA pay hostage, all to disenfranchise tens of thousands of American citizens over delusions of voter fraud. Republicans now say that he is walking away from that, but the president has yet to clarify his ultimatum. The only way we are going to get out of this mess is if we know the president is on the same page as the Republicans. Now, Democrats are continuing to push for modest reforms. And just as Democrats have been very clear, we will immediately fund TSA, FEMA, Coast Guard, and CISA while talks continue on ICE and Border Patrol. But we've also made very clear that if we are talking about funding any part of ICE or CBP, we absolutely must take some key steps to rein them in. We should pay TSA today and finalize a deal to fund the rest of the department and rein in ICE and Border Patrol.
A deputy TSA administrator testifies on the impact of the DHS shutdown. The White House will not seek an Iran war authorization from Congress, and the Save America Act could limit how rural voters access the ballots. For the stories that impact our democracy, here's today's edition of 2026 Talks.
According to Homeland Security, nearly 500 TSA agents have quit since agency funding ran out more than a month ago. By Friday, the government will owe TSA workers $1 billion in late paychecks. Deputy Administrator Han Nguyen McNeil testified to the House Homeland Security Committee.
Many in our workforce have missed bill payments, received eviction notices, had their cars repossessed and utilities shut off, lost their child care, defaulted on loans, damaged their credit line, and drained their retirement savings.
ICE agents are at work in U.S. airports, but may also be assigned more controversial tasks. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt says the administration won't seek war authorization from Congress.
We've also had our top national security officials go to Capitol Hill to brief lawmakers, again, out of courtesy and out of respect for them. So at this moment, it's unnecessary, but of course, the president in this administration will always abide by the law.
Lawmakers from both parties have called the military actions illegal. 2,000 to 3,000 paratroopers are deploying to the region, adding to the forces there. Leavitt insists the war will probably be over in a month and a half, although Iranian leaders have rejected a ceasefire proposal and are demanding payment for the damage. Republican House leaders say they're confident about passing a $200 billion supplemental military appropriation. Opponents of the conflict in Congress may try to stop that, arguing without a war powers vote, the budget is one of the few ways they can act. On a right-wing podcast, Borders Are Tom Homan said falsely that immigration agents have a legal role in securing elections. Notably, Homan joined a list of White House officials refusing to rule out sending ICE to polling sites this fall. Watchdogs say rural voters could find it harder to access the ballot if Congress passes the Save America Act. The strict voter ID law would require them to drive long distances to register in person at their county seat. Greta Bedekovics with the Center of American Progress says their research shows many would have to drive 4 hours round trip.
This bill has asked people to either have a passport, pay $165 to get one, or to have an original certified copy of their birth certificate. This is really not voter ID, and it's critical that Americans understand that.
An amendment to the bill would ban mail-in voting except for people in the military, hospitalized, or disabled. Mail-in voting is especially popular among rural voters. With Mark Wayne Mullen moving to Homeland Security, his Oklahoma Senate seat will be open. Governor Kevin Stitt has tapped Energy Executive Alan Armstrong to serve the rest of Mullen's term, although by law, Armstrong has to pledge not to run in November. Stitt says Armstrong's values match those of the Sooner State.
He's a strong business leader who understands the power of free markets and limited government. He spent his career fighting for Oklahoma's energy industry and providing affordable, reliable energy to all of of America.
Armstrong says in his abbreviated term he wants to speed up permitting for energy projects. Trump has endorsed Republican Representative Kevin Hearn for a full six-year term. I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
Jewish and Palestinian human rights supporters have pushed Washington State to divest millions invested in Caterpillar. Mark Richardson reports.
Coalition of Jewish and Palestinian human rights advocates has successfully pressured the Washington State Treasurer's Office to divest $53 million in investments in the equipment company Caterpillar. The group, cut ties with genocide, charges that for 60 years the Israeli military has used Caterpillar bulldozers to tear down homes in Gaza and other Palestinian territories. Ray Levine, an organizer with Jewish Voices for Peace in Seattle, says state officials listened to them and took action.
They initiated their environmental social governance guidelines back in 2021 and divested from fossil fuel companies. Their portfolio hasn't included weapons companies, but we pointed out that they did hold Caterpillar bonds.
Levine says the company continues to supply machinery that is used for what she calls the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. Caterpillar released a statement saying it does not condone the illegal or immoral use of any Caterpillar equipment, but did not say whether it would stop selling to Israel. Levine says the bulldozers are considered military aid and are provided with U.S. taxpayer dollars. She says local companies have a personal interest in stopping the bulldozers because of a fatal incident in Gaza that killed an Olympia-born rights activist.
Here in Washington State, we especially are aware of Caterpillar because Rachel Corrie, Washingtonian activist, was killed by Israeli soldiers driving a Caterpillar bulldozer in 2003.
Levine says the group advocated for the passage of the Responsible Investment Act, a bill filed in the state legislature that provided an ethics framework for the state investment board's dealings. She says that though the bill did not pass this time, they plan to bring it back next year.
It is possible to make progress and to really reduce the money going to support these companies that are helping the war effort in these places, especially now.
I'm Mark Richardson.
Remote tribal communities plug into microgrids for backup power. And an Indigenous artist is selected for a special honor at the Alaska Folk Festival. Antonia Gonzalez has more in today's edition of National Native News.
Microgrids can be a lifeline in remote areas prone to power outages, according to local and tribal leaders in Northern California. Leaders spoke at an event on energy security in an era of wildfires, drought, and sea level rise, all linked to climate change. Suzanne Potter has more.
Dr. Arnie Jacobson, director of the Schatz Energy Research Center at Cal Poly Humboldt, says microgrids often involve solar panels plus battery storage.
So during normal operation, they're connected to the regional grid and they can export power and generate revenue. And during a regional grid outage, they operate in island mode and can provide resilience energy services.
Microgrids have gained popularity in recent years as utilities have had to shut off power intermittently during wildfires and high wind events. Jacobson adds that the Willow Creek and Hoopa substations and their associated circuits in the Humboldt area are frequently on the top 10 list of least reliable circuits in the state. Beth Burks, who directs the Redwood Coastal Energy Authority, says its microgrid serves as backup power to the airport and kept it online for 15 hours in December 2022 when an earthquake knocked out power.
We're all familiar with how important it is to keep the airport going. We do our emergency medical transport out of there. And the Coast Guard serves 250 miles of search and rescue territory. And again, we can keep them going when we go into islanding.
Islanding is the term for a system that can kick in and power a local area when the main utility grid goes down. Heidi Morganup with the Blue Lake Rancheria Tribe says its microgrid saved the day during the 2022 blackout, keeping several tribal buildings running so they could provide ice, gas, medical care, and lodging.
We want to be known as a safe place to go, the island in times of despair. We're a very small rural community, but we are engaged in technological advances that can help rural global energy access.
I'm Suzanne Potter.
Ketchikan-based artist Savannah Lucornu was selected as this year's poster artist for the Alaska Folk Festival in Juneau. The annual spring event seeks art submissions from Alaska creatives. For festival merchandise, including a poster, KRBD's Hunter Morrison sat down with her to discuss how the opportunity will help expand representation of Indigenous artists throughout Alaska.
Can you tell me a little bit about what inspires your work as an artist?
I'm part of three different tribes. I'm Tsim Shian, Haida, and Nez Perce. So a lot of my inspiration comes from the art styles of my tribes, as well as my family, surroundings, environment, friends.
And can you tell me a little bit more about what mediums of art that you specialize in?
Yeah, so mainly I draw and I paint. I do a lot of traditional drawing, but I also do digital drawing as well, too. So working with Procreate on my iPad. And then I also do painting, mainly acrylic, but I have done watercolor here and there.
How will this opportunity expand not only your work as an artist, but sort of expand the celebration of Indigenous people and Indigenous art?
What I'm hoping for, being the artist for this year's Folkfest, is that my art gets started to seen more widely throughout Alaska, I suppose. I will say it's not my most obvious Indigenous design. I will say all of my art inherently becomes Indigenous because I am Indigenous, but at the same time, there's no form line in it. There's no traditional Native art in it for this design, but I still hope that means that people look into even my own art and see more of what I do and that people just explore more of it.
That was Hunter Morrison and Savannah LeCornu. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Thanks so much for tuning in with us here on the KBOO Evening News on this Thursday, March 26, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Isabel Charlet, producer Annette Newell, our engineer Otto, and our director of evening news, Althea Billings. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs